From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Striptease, Carl Hiaasen's comic novel pitting a sleazy politician against a star stripper at Miami's Eager Beaver Club has been adapted into a new film starring Demi Moore as the stripper. We'll talk with Carl Hiaasen. Also, travel writer-adventurer Joe Kane tells us about meeting the fiercest, most isolated tribe of the Amazon, the Waorani. Book critic Maureen Carrigan recommends what new titles to take to the beach. And John Powers reviews the next action movie of the summer, The Rock. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Supreme Court has rejected a last effort to block Georgia's new congressional district map. It's to be used for the first time this November. It features only one majority black district. This map was drawn up after an original redistricting plan was struck down as the product of unlawful racial gerrymandering. The Supreme Court has already agreed to review the validity of this newest voting map. But today's ruling means that whatever decision the court finally makes won't have any effect on this November's voting. The nation's jobless rate rose to 5.6% last month, up 5 from 5.4% in April. Despite the increase, economists say the overall jobs market appears to be strong. There were 348,000 jobs created last month, a number that surprised economists like Hugh Johnson with First Albany Corporation.
It's fairly clear from the employment numbers for the month of May that this economy continues to pick up a little bit of steam in the second quarter, right from a fairly strong or impressive first quarter. So there's no question this economy is stronger than anybody had really previously expected.
Economist Hugh Johnson. The weather's begun to cooperate as firefighters in Alaska struggle to control a massive wildfire that's charred over 40,000 acres north of Anchorage. The winds that were fanning the flames have quieted, temperatures have cooled off, and some rain is forecast for the area this weekend. Joe Stamm of Alaska's Interagency Management Team told NBC that over 1,000 firefighters battling the blaze are making progress.
Our crews got some line constructed that we held. We're estimating about 15% of the line contained, which means we have it where we think it's not going to get away from us. We did a lot of aerial retardant work on the fire where we had some flare-ups. We put retardant on it.
The U.S. Forest Service says the blaze could be contained by Monday night. A key witness in the war crimes trial of Captain Eric Priebke broke his hip today when he jumped off his balcony from his second-floor hotel room. Regina Sansaloni reports from Rome.
Former Nazi SS Major Karl Haas was due to testify in the Priebke trial being heard before a Rome military tribunal. Priebke is accused of masterminding the massacre of 335 Italian men in the Ardetine cave just outside the capital in 1944. While he admits to his involvement, Priebke has maintained that he was only following orders. Haas, who worked in the German embassy in occupied Rome, was expected to confirm that Priebke himself ordered the murders and was also responsible for the killing of an Italian trade unionist and the deportation to Buchenwald of an Italian royal family member. It is not clear if Haas, who is recovering in a Rome hospital, was trying to escape or attempting suicide. For National Public Radio, this is Regina Sansaloni in Rome.
On Wall Street, the Dow has fallen nearly 36 points to 5,631. Trading is very heavy. This is NPR. Federal agents are investigating another fire at a black church. This one was in Charlotte, North Carolina. A wooden sanctuary on the grounds of the church was burned. No one was hurt. The sanctuary was nearly 100 years old. There has been a spate of arsons at black churches in the South, but no conspiracy has been discovered. 26 fires at black churches have been reported in the last year and a half. Agents from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms are part of the investigation. The final report on the Air Force jet crash that killed Commerce Secretary Ron Brown and 34 others in April in Croatia will be made public today. The investigation found a combination of factors led to the accident. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
Inclement weather, questionable pilot decisions, and an unsophisticated guidance system all contributed to the April 3rd crash. Defense Secretary William Perry told reporters that there is no single thing you can point to, but that the decision by Air Force officers in Germany to allow the plane to fly into the uncertified Dubrovnik airport certainly played a part in the accident. Perry also said that at the time of the crash, in marginal weather, the jet was being guided by two ground beacons, one of which was either not being received by the cockpit or was not working. Because of the unsophisticated equipment on the ground, said Perry, the pilots did not realize they were being blown off course towards a mountain. The president of the Accident Investigation Board, General Charles Coolidge, will release additional findings early this afternoon at the Pentagon. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
The Centers for Disease Control say guns now account for nearly 3 of every 4 homicides in the country. That's a big jump from 10 years ago when the ratio was more like 6 in 10. The CDC compared murders between 1985 and 1994. In 94, there were nearly 24,000 homicides in the United States. More than 17,000 of them involved gunfire. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Advanta, a financial services provider to consumers and small businesses, and sponsor of the upcoming Cezanne documentary on public television. And from Penguin Books, publishers of Penguin Classics. For 50 years, the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross.
Your Honor, my ex-husband is a thief. That hardly qualifies him to raise a 7-year-old child.
Neither does being a mother without a job.
My lawyer told me this appeal is going to cost me $20,000. I mean, is there a shot in hell that I can make that in 6 weeks?
Erin Grant is desperate. And desperate times call for desperate measures.
One of the more anticipated summer movies this year is Striptease, starring Demi Moore. It's based on a novel by Miami Herald columnist Carl Hiaasen. The story involves a shady politician named David Dilbeck, who's in the pocket of the sugar industry and is a sucker for a naked woman. He's obsessed with Erin Grant, a new dancer at the Eager Beaver, an upscale Florida strip club. She works there to raise money so that she can regain custody of her child. Like Hiaasen's other novels, Striptease deals with the corrupt relationship between business and politics in the Sunshine State. Hiaasen is one of those rare species, a Florida native. And if he had his way, he would drive the tourists from the beaches, rip up the malls, close Disney World, and return the state to the pastoral beauty of his youth. While he's upset with the state of Florida, it does provide him grist for his columns and his novels. He said finding a model for the corrupt Congressman Dilbeck was easy.
You could almost, fire a dart gun in the halls of Congress and in anyone who might fit the category. But I mean, the actual event, the opening of the book, for example, which takes place in one of these new so-called upscale adult clubs in Fort Lauderdale, where the congressman behaves rather badly and draws a lot of attention to himself. And that was inspired by an actual incident in which my own congressman in 1978 was a six-term Republican congressman from Broward County, Florida, was arrested in a strip joint at about 2 in the morning on all sorts of problem charges that had to do with his behavior relating to the women and the other customers. And it was pretty much the end of his political career. And it always stuck with me that here was a guy whose job was pretty much a cinch, and he kept getting reelected, you know, every 2 years. Why? What compelled him to do that sort of thing, to risk it all just to go in there for some cheap thrills? And so, you know, that sort of stuck with me, and that launched the book, but there are many other models and inspirations for what happens after that.
Well, what kind of research did you do for the book?
In terms of the political stuff, it's just obvious. It's on the front pages every day. In terms of writing about, for instance, the sugar industry, Big Sugar, I do that on a regular basis in my column, and it certainly we covered well in the Miami Herald. So, I mean, that was right at my fingertips, as it were. The other research about the clubs, I had to pop in here and there, and I, as I said, less than you would think. I mean, my main interest was in talking to some of the performers who, especially the women who were single mothers with kids, because that's the hero of the book. The heroine of the book is a single mother with a child. And I wanted to find out what the kind of struggles you have trying to have a job like that and raise a kid by yourself at the same time. So they were great conversations and they were great interviews. The only trouble was that they would be interrupted about every 3.5 minutes when they just get up spontaneously and begin dancing and throwing lingerie around, and it's distracting, and it's somewhat hard to keep your, not only your train of thought, but I mean, and they're very nonchalant about it to them because it's just business. But when you're sitting there having, you know, what you think is a very quiet, subdued conversation, and this one dancer was showing me pictures of her daughter in school and everything, and the next second they're sort of up on the table, doing what they do. It was tough to interview under those circumstances.
Well, the women in your novel, or the women that work at this strip joint, have really more class, more daring, more smart than most of the other characters in the book. Did you find that to be true?
Absolutely. I mean, the men in these, the customers in these joints are the suckers. I mean, men are suckers anyway, but I mean, the show, when I went into these places, it was, believe it or not, it became much more interesting to watch the behavior of the men than it was the dancers, because the dancers were, I mean, it's a very cold-blooded sort of mission, and that is to separate you from your money, because that's what they do for a living. I mean, they dance, and you give them a tip, and that's how they make their money. But and they're very smart and cunning about it. The men, however, especially after a couple of drinks, are just total, you know, they fall hopelessly in love with whatever pair of legs is on the table at the time.
Empty. Because they think she's doing it for him.
Oh, right? They think that they've just charmed her into just disrobing on a moment's notice. You know, when in fact she's actually thinking about, gee, I got to go to the laundromat after work. They think she's thinking about them and what a handsome, dashing guy. They would tell me their tricks. It was really interesting. They would say, well, the way we usually work it, if you muss up their hair a little bit, the customer they're talking about, or if they're wearing a necktie, you adjust their necktie a little bit, and you've got them. They're hooked. They'll sit there all evening, and they'll give you every bit of cash they got, and it's absolutely true. I mean, I watched it. It was amazing, and the guys are just predictable like that. We're just total saps, and, you know, I don't know whether it's ego or alcohol or that deadly combination of both of them. Then at the end of the evening, of course, the girls vanish. And they can't, the guys are all sitting, well, where did she go? Well, you're out of money, pal. She's gone.
Well, there's a phrase called schmoing out.
Now, I've heard that. That isn't in the book, but I mean, yeah. I've heard that phrase used in the jargon in these clubs. And that is when a guy just sort of totally goes gaga over a particular dancer, and she dances pretty much until he's out of money. And now, though, some of the clubs in Lauderdale, they've installed cash machines, which is really deadly. Not only can you spend your whole paycheck on a Friday night, you can go and on credit, you know, completely bankrupt your entire family for the sake of one evening of dancing. So they've got these cash machines you go to now. So it's really amazing. It's an amazing enterprise. And it's, like I said, it's proliferated to the point. The club owner in Lauderdale also owns quite a number of clubs in Manhattan and in Dallas and other places. I mean, he's a multimillionaire. He probably has 60 clubs going around the country right now. So this is sort of a new thing, the idea of going in a coat and tie and it being a very respectable place where no hanky-panky at all goes on. I mean, the place is crawling with guys with no necks who just would love to remove you at a moment's notice. So there's nothing untoward happening. Except, guys are sitting there sort of parting with their money.
How much money could a woman make on a typical night?
One night, a dancer that I talked to, the night I was there, she made $1,500.
Cash?
Cash, yeah. And that's a good night. Most of them make between $2,500 and $3,500 a week.
Do they do it for the money, or do they also get off on the power of kind of taunting
both.
Men in the audience?
Yeah. Both. I mean, because it is a tease after all, but there's certainly an element of control. I'm not sure power is right, but they're in control and they know it. So, and there's a little bit of a thrill to be the center of attention. Some of them were very frank about that when they talked to me, because A, it was very safe. Nobody laid a hand on you, except, of course, in the friction dancing joints, and they were... Then it wasn't the customer, it was the dancer, again, who sort of dictated the terms of that little enterprise. But the by and large, they were in it for the money. And most of them, and I had several of them say to me, look, you know, how long can I do this? Maybe 2-3 years? I can put a lot of money in the bank. I can put my kid in private school. I can pay off my car. Many of them were in college. I had one, and I'm very seriously, who had already applied to the FBI Academy, and she was dancing that night I was there, and... I mean, there are no stereotypes that go along with this. There's just a lot of different reasons why they were there. Oddly enough, I think I only met one who honestly believed that she was going to be discovered, that some movie director was going to be walk in and spot her, and then she was going to be whisked off to Hollywood. I talked to quite a number of the dancers, and I really only, it was a very young woman who was maybe 18, 19 years old, and who really thought that this was her ticket to stardom. Most of them were much smarter than that, and they know what it was all about. It was a business enterprise.
You feel comfortable in places like
no,
this?
No, uh-uh.
Not at all?
No, not really. And it gets tedious and boring after a while. It honestly does. I mean, I don't know how to describe it. There's a character in the book, the bouncer in the book, or I should say the floor manager. They don't like to be called bouncers. Shad is his name, and his problem is he's been in the business 11 years, and he is totally numb to the sight of the most gorgeous woman. I mean, does anything for him now, except the only thing that excites him is the sight of women with clothes on, because he's been working in nude joints for 11 years, and he's had it. And he's trying to get out because he realizes he's just been, you know, almost bored to tears by the whole thing. And that is something I drew from talking to people who worked there and from sort of watching the faces on some of the guys, the bouncers in these places. I mean, they might as well have been working on a Chrysler assembly line or selling automotive parts at Kmart. I mean, they were really, you know, it was like they were in another world because they've been at it so long.
That's journalist and novelist Carl Hiaasen. The movie version of his novel, Striptease, opens at the end of June. Coming up, Carl Hiaasen on hurricanes. This is Fresh Air. Hurricane season got its official start on June 1st. Carl Hiaasen's latest novel, Stormy Weather, is about the scam artists and corrupt insurance and construction companies that take advantage of hurricane victims. Here's Carl Hiaasen reading from Stormy Weather about a scam artist named Gil Peck, who makes his money during the hurricane season.
Among the stream of outlaws who raced south in the feverish hours following the hurricane was a man named Gil Peck. His plan was to pass himself off as an experienced mason, steal what he could in the way of advanced deposits, then haul ass back to Alabama. The scam had worked flawlessly against victims of Hurricane Hugo in South Carolina, and Gil Peck was confident it would work in Miami, too. He arrived in a 4-ton flatbed carrying a small but authentic-looking load of red bricks, which he'd ripped off from an unguarded construction site in Mobile, a new cancer wing for a pediatric hospital. Gil Peck had caught the festive groundbreaking on TV. That afternoon, he'd backed up the flatbed, helped himself to the bricks, and driven nonstop to South Florida. So far, business was booming. Gil Peck had collected almost $2,600 in cash from half a dozen desperate homeowners, all of whom expected him to return the following Saturday morning with his truckload of bricks. By then, of course, Gil Peck would be northbound and gone. By day, he worked the hustle. By night, he scavenged hurricane debris. The big flatbed conveyed an air of authority, and no one questioned its presence. Even after curfew, the National Guardsmen waved him through the flashing barricades. Many valuables had survived the storm's thrashing, and Gil Peck became an expert at mining the rubble. An inventory of his 2-day bounty included a bagel toaster, a Stairmaster, a silver tea set, 3 off-brand assault rifles, a Panasonic cellular telephone, 2 pairs of men's golf spikes, a waterproof kilogram package of hashish, a brass chandelier, a scuba tank, a gold-class ring from the University of Miami, a set of police handcuffs, a collection of rare Finnish pornography, a Michael Jackson hand puppet, an unopened bottle of 100-milligram Darvocets, a box set of Willie Nelson albums, a Loomis fly rod, a birdcage, and 21 pairs of women's bikini-style panties. Exploring the demolished remains of a mobile home park, Gil Peck was a happy fellow. There was a bounce to his step as he followed the yellow beam of the flashlight from one ruin to another. Thanks to the National Guard, the Highway Patrol, and the Dade County Police, Gil Peck was completely alone and unmolested in the summer night, free to plunder. And what he spied in the middle of a shuffleboard court made his greedy heart flutter with joy. A jumbo TV dish. The hurricane undoubtedly had uprooted it from some millionaire's estate and tossed it here for Gil Peck to salvage. With the flashlight, he traced the outer parabola and found one small dent. Otherwise, the 8-foot satellite receiver was in top condition. Gil Peck grinned and thought, man, I must be living right. A dish that big was worth a couple grand easy. Gil Peck thought it might fit nicely in his own backyard, behind the chicken coops. He envisioned free HBO for the rest of his natural life.
And that's Carl Hiaasen reading from his latest novel. It's called Stormy Weather. So as a journalist and as someone who has covered hurricanes in South Florida, how many Gil Pecks move in on the aftermath of a hurricane?
Well, when I was a kid and these things happened, I don't remember the sort of a wave, the assault wave of this kind of scoundrel that we had after Hurricane Andrew. And certainly the folks in South Carolina remember after Hugo and maybe Camille in the Gulf Coast states. I think it's sort of a new phenomenon. But when you had and part of it is the media. We had extensive, vast media coverage of that storm when Andrew hit in 92. And I think it inspired a lot of bad folks to try to come down and take advantage of the situation. And they did, sadly enough, along with all the volunteers and the church groups and the National Guard and the Red Cross. You had these kinds of maggots who sort of crawled their way down there and made a lot of money and got out before they could be arrested.
Well, how were they able to work so easily?
There was no law and order. I mean, after a storm, you had, in a space of 4 hours, 200,000 people put out of their homes, 125,000 homes destroyed partially or completely. Everyone's attention was to the survivors and to restoring some sort of, you know, communication, electricity, traffic lights. You can't imagine, unless you've been through a hurricane, there's just nothing. And so these people, all the efforts of the authorities were just traffic control. And if you're desperate and you're sitting there and your kids don't have a roof over their head and their water is dripping, mosquitoes, and somebody pulls up with a truck that says he's a roofer or a mason or whatever he is, and you just want to get some shelter and you're willing to pay them even though they're not licensed and even though they may have been a bartender the night before and just decided all of a sudden to put on roofs. And that happened a lot.
And would these maggots, as you describe them, would they target particular kinds of people, or was everyone in such desperate states?
There was no shortage of victims. You know, I mean, it was just an open season, and this is just one element. I mean, you had other kinds of folks down there who certainly appear in the novel as well. But the opportunism, it was at a fever pitch. It was a chance. Also, you got to realize that not just in the days after the storms, but in the weeks after the storm, you had millions of dollars in insurance money that was coming into South Florida. Millions and millions of dollars. A lot of these companies were paying off very quickly. It's good PR to do that after a storm. So you had people with some cash.
A lot of cash.
And FEMA was down there giving out checks to people. So you had folks walking around. Mm-hmm. And with that money, you know, it worked both ways. You had homeowners who thought they could sort of make a deal. They got $10,000 to put a new roof on. What if they could find someone to put the roof on for $5,000? And then the other $5,000 they could maybe put in a new swimming pool. And that happened a lot. And then they found out that whoever they hired to put on the roof may have been not exactly qualified. So, you know, it was an unbelievable time. There was an actual boom in terms of the economy, as bizarre as this sounds. In the months after the storm, there was a tremendous boom in South Florida's economy because all this insurance money. And now we're just getting almost 3 years later to the point where that money's spent. And we're sort of catching up with the rest of the country and sort of flattening out.
Well, who do you blame? And in your book, in your novel, there are many targets here. But who do you hold ultimately responsible for the kind of ripoffs that you both have written about as a journalist and as a novelist?
Well, the ripoffs being one part of it. I mean, you have to look at the whole political structure that says, you know, we live in a hurricane zone. And you can bet that there's going to be more hurricanes, and just as there have been. So what we're going to do is we're going to cram 5 million human beings into the Gold Coast of Florida in houses that are built like popsicle sticks, many of them, and we're just going to dare the hurricane to come. And when it comes, we're going to claim we didn't know it was going to be this bad. So the whole political – in Florida, the whole political engine is fueled with construction money, development money, bank money. Growth is the industry. We don't produce a lot of other things. And the problem is that it's nature's way of saying, all right, this is the price you pay. It would be like saying, I'm going to take my life savings and build a big house for my family on the San Andreas Fault because I don't think there's going to be any more earthquakes. I mean, that's about how bright it is.
Carl Hiaasen is my guest. When was the last time you went to Disney World? Or did you ever take your son when he was little?
When he was very little, yeah. We went there a couple times. And at the time, I was living and working in Central Florida, so I had to go there on some assignments. And, you know, and when you have a little kid, it's a different experience. Mm-hmm. But when you have to cover it as a journalist, and you sort of, and there's some, believe me, everyone there is very nice. They're almost too nice. They're so nice, you want someone
to program nice.
I know,
they?
And you want someone to throw something. You want to hear someone cuss. you want to see something go wrong. And I'll never forget what was raining one day, bitterly raining, and I had to go across the park to meet a celebrity for an interview. And the public relations person who was with me says, "Now I'm going to take you a secret way to this to the interview, but you've got to promise you won't write about this." I said, "What way?" And he goes, "We're going underground." And I'd never been in the catacombs under Disney World before. And you go down, literally like they move a dumpster and a trap door comes up, and you go down the trap door, and all of a sudden you're down there, and this is where all the garbage is moved, this is where all the food, and this is where all the characters have to hang out before they pop up on the streets. And so the first thing I see is like Mickey Mouse sitting down there. He's got his head off, and it's under his arm. You know, he's like drinking a Coke or smoking a cigarette or something. And it was kind of a neat, it was the first human view of the park that I'd had, and so I incorporated some of that into the novel. But I don't particularly enjoy the place because nothing spontaneous ever happens there. I mean, I tell people if you really want to go have some fun, go to like the Gatorland Zoo where they have like 6,000 alligators that half the time are eating each other. You know, I mean, you want to see what Florida. This the problem with Disney World is it could be anywhere. It could be in Mesa, Arizona.
So. Well, the thing about the Disney experience is that what you experience is what I experience. I mean, it is the kind of franchise fast food.
Well, you know,
entertainment.
And when things happen spontaneously, it doesn't always go well there. A few years ago, I'd written about, the Herald had written about this at some length. They have some frontier land or frontier river, I don't know what. Anyway, it's a log camp. For some reason, some buzzards, wild turkey buzzards, of which we have many in Florida, started showing up. They had a tremendous attraction for the place. And these were not audio animated. These were real vultures. And the Disney people didn't know what to do because they didn't want any real like buzzards, because the buzzards were like looking at the caged birds with great lust and hunger. And so the Disney solution at the time was a couple of their folks kind of got out of hand and tried to settle the buzzard issue with baseball bats. And the animal rights folks got very upset, and Disney had to apologize to the buzzards, to the Buzzard Friends Society or whatever it was. And then, of course, they responded with this great public relations thing. Now they have a huge, you know, sort of, you know, endangered species program and everything else. But at the time, it was an illustration of they didn't really know how to cope with Florida nature. And so I wanted a theme park where nature intruded once in a while.
Carl Hiaasen is a columnist with the Miami Herald. His latest novel, Stormy Weather, will be out in paperback in August. The film Striptease, based on Hiaasen's 1993 novel and starring Demi Moore, will open later this month. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Coming up, the spear-killing, tree-walking, fiercest tribe of the Amazon. We talk with writer Joe Kane about how and why he met the Waorani. Also, Maureen Corrigan's summer reading list and busting into Alcatraz. John Powers reviews The Rock. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. If summer reading means suspense novels, spy thrillers, and or works of wistful nostalgia, book critic Maureen Corrigan has a few suggestions.
It's a soft, sunny day, and you're lying in a beach chair with a pile of books by your side, a sampling of those great tomes you've resolved to finally get around to reading this summer. Your hand drifts lazily down towards the pile. It brushes past The Divine Comedy, Virginia Woolf's Orlando, and firmly grasps a copy of Neanderthal. But hey, don't feel too guilty. According to Gertrude Stein, Picasso spent his Sundays off reading the funnies. And if you're craving escapism, you pick the right book. Neanderthal, a first novel by New York Times London Bureau Chief John Darnton, provides readers with an unadulterated yabba-dabba-doo good time. Neanderthal's plot turns on the unsettling what-if premise that hominids, evolutionary intermediates who combine ape-like and human features, still exist. The action takes place in a remote region of Western Asia, where paleontologists Matt Madison and Susan Arnott travel to discover the fate of their mentor, who disappeared on a fossil dig. Once there, Matt and Susan run afoul of a murderous gang of proto-humans who crack craniums and slurp brains for breakfast. Thanks, however, to a timely avalanche, our heroes are rescued by another tribe of Neanderthals who prefer to make love, not war. But when the villains recapture Susan, Matt must transform his pacifist hosts into guerrilla fighters and effect a daredevil rescue. Neanderthal is perfect vacation reading, entertaining, mildly educational, and scary enough to make you grateful that the only Neanderthals you're likely to meet are the kind cutting into your lane on the expressway to the beach. Mystery writer Nevada Barr has been justly praised for her evocative images of the great outdoors. But in Firestorm, her fourth novel starring National Park Service Ranger Anna Pigeon, Barr ingeniously resurrects the classic locked-room mystery plot and weds it to a harrowing tale of environmental crimes and deadly divided loyalties. When the novel opens, Anna is fighting a forest fire in Northern California. An approaching cold front whips the fire into a firestorm, turning the canyon where the park rangers are working into an inferno. Anna and her colleagues desperately try to outrace the fire, but finally must take refuge in silver tents, nicknamed shaken bakes, they carry in their backpacks. The fire rages over them, and when the smoke clears, one firefighter is found in his tent with a knife in his back. Firestorm is a brilliantly executed mystery that brings to mind Dorothy Sayers' flooded masterpiece, The Nine Tailors. In both books, natural disasters of biblical proportions devastate the land and function as eerie instruments of justice. How can you resist an espionage novel that contains a chapter whose opening words are, "Night train to Madrid"? Buy me a ticket. I'm there. The World at Night is Alan First's fourth World War II-era suspense novel, and like its predecessors, it's imbued with a doom-laden romanticism and an elegantly spare, swift-moving plot. First protagonist, Jean Casson, is a jaded 42-year-old French film producer, a connoisseur of wine and women. But like his hard-bitten prototype, Humphrey Bogart, in Casablanca, Casson rediscovers his moral courage when the Germans march into his beloved Paris in the spring of 1940. First vividly recreates Paris during the early months of the occupation, when Parisians thought they could shame the Germans out of their city by just haughtily refusing to meet their eyes. We get a sense here of how easily one could become a tacit collaborator. Casson himself agrees to go on making films, even though his movies must now be approved by the Film Control Board run by Goebbels. Then, one day, Casson receives a phone call from a banker in London who backed some of his former projects. Mentioning the call to a friend, Casson is told it's impossible. The Germans cut the phone lines under the Channel months before. Slowly, queasily, it dawns on Casson that he's just received a feeler from a British spy ring. Before long, he's ferrying suitcases full of clandestine cash and rendezvousing with RAF planes on pitch-black farm fields. And at the end of this superb thriller, Casson undertakes a solo mission so foolhardy it'll make your heart stop. Why read books at all during the summer instead of mountain biking or kayaking or rollerblading? Well, if tanned and toned friends are already making you feel bad about your sedentary summer pleasures, inoculate yourself with a copy of Lynn Sharon Schwartz's book-length autobiographical essay, Ruined by Reading. In it, Schwartz documents and defends her own lifelong enchantment with books, thumbing through B-list childhood favorites like the Little Golden Books to Jane Eyre and Ellery Queen and the works of Natalia Ginsberg and Henry James. This is the kind of insightful, chatty essay where you might find yourself, as I did, scribbling, "Me too," next to every other paragraph. Reading Schwartz will help you retrieve and cherish any memories you have of lazy summer afternoons spent eyes glued to Robinson Crusoe, and it will whet your appetite for reading feasts to come.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Neanderthal by John Darnton, Firestorm by Nevada Barr, The World at Night by Alan First, and Ruin by Reading by Lynn Sharon Schwartz. Coming up, adventurer Joe Kane. This is Fresh Air. When Joe Kane traveled the Amazon 10 years ago, he was shot at, suffered malaria, and came close to drowning many times. He chronicled his journey down the treacherous river in his first book, Running the Amazon. In the early 90s, when Kane worked for the Rainforest Action Network, a mysterious letter arrived with no return address. It was from a member of the Waurani, a small nomadic tribe of warriors in South America. They were in a fight with the multinational oil companies that were polluting and damaging their land while producing oil in the region. Kane traveled into the Ecuadorian rainforest to find them. Joe Kane's book about his experiences is called Savages. He lived and traveled with the Waurani, seeing firsthand the environmental impact of oil exploration on the rainforest and on their way of life.
They're extremely isolated. There's only about 1,300 of them, and they have defended a territory the size of Massachusetts for as long as anyone knows. They're considered the fiercest forest people on the planet. They're spear killers. In fact, they're so isolated that their language is unrelated to any other on Earth, although, as I was to come and find out, some of the younger men speak Spanish. They've picked it up on their travels. Nobody could tell me how to get in touch with the Huarani. Nobody could offer any way of finding out whether that letter was for real or not. It was potentially a very powerful letter. So I left RAN, got an assignment from the New Yorker, and went down to Ecuador. The one clue we had was on the dateline on the letter said Coca, which is a little western, wild west sort of town in the Ecuadorian Amazon. I flew into Quito and then down into Coca and started to look for the Huarani.
Well, let's find out how you got there, because this is certainly where part of your adventure begins. You had the name of this town, Coca.
Coca.
And you had, I guess, some idea about how the Amazon works from your previous travels. Mm-hmm. But where did you begin? Where do you go when you don't have a detailed map to work off of?
Well, I had heard the story of Alejandro Labaca, a Capuchin monk. In 1987, the Braspetro, the Brazilian national oil company, and apparently Texaco, well, it's not clear if Texaco is involved, but they're said to be have been. In any case, they spotted the Tagiri, one of the fiercest of the Huarani clans. They spotted a Tagiri settlement by air and then sent a team of mercenaries after the Tagiri to clear them out of the oil zone. There was a skirmish. A couple of Tagiri apparently were killed. Some of the mercenaries were injured. And Alejandro Labaca, the bishop of Coca, heard about this. And Labaca had learned some Huarani from clans he had met on the edges of the territory. And he went to the oil companies and the military and said, look, please let me intervene and try to move the Tagiri away rather than have you kill them. So Conoco dropped Labaca in the Tagiri clearing, came back 3 days later and found his body pinned to the ground with 17 palmwood spears, each of them jutting out of his corpse like porcupine quills. His body had been punctured in 89 places, and of course he was dead. I had heard that story, so I went to the Capuchin mission, and I happened to meet Labaca's best friend, a priest named Jose Miguel Goldaras, who still had the 17 spears taken from Labaca's body. And I said, look, we got this letter. I'm trying to find out if it's real. How can I meet the Huarani? And he kind of studied me, and he said, do you want to meet the Huarani? And he said, they're right over there. And he pointed to the back of the mission compound, and there was this funky little cinder block shed, and I walked over and knocked on the door, and a voice said in Spanish, are you coming here? And so I said, well, yes, I'm coming here. And the door opened, and I walked in, and there were a half dozen young men sitting there wearing t-shirts and blue jeans, not saying a word, just watching me. And one of them had a pair of headphones on, and he had a wire going from the headphones down to his right hip pocket. And to make conversation, I asked him in Spanish, I said, what are you listening to? And he looked at me very solemnly, and he said, I am listening to my pants.
Did the guy have a Walkman?
No, he just had the headphones. He wore the headphones. They were not connected to anything at all. He had the wire, and he tucked into his pants and just wore them around because he thought they were cool. And the joke was on me.
Absolutely. You have an interesting photograph in your book. It's actually comparing your feet to the feet of a Huarani. And what's most striking is the fact that they have this, what could be described as an opposable toe, just the way you can move your thumb down. It looks as if they can move their toe down, or perhaps it's even permanently extended.
Well, they call themselves tree walkers. They spend as much as half their lives, waking lives, up in the canopy, because that's where so much of the life of the rainforest is. And their feet, over time, adapt to walking on tree branches, or, for example, crossing rivers. They'll knock down a 40-foot-tall tree, knock it over a raging river, and then use it as a bridge and just walk across the log, carrying, you know, up to 100 pounds at a time, and never fall off. And their feet curl so well around the trees, the trunks and branches, that, well, you could call it a deformity, but it's really an adaptation to a need.
What does Huarani sound like? Can you give us some words just to get us, give us a feel?
What do I still remember? It's been a while. Mbotogobopa, which means basically, I am coming here. It's kind of it's very nasal. And so my name, for example, they would try to say Joe,
right,
but it would come out Chong. So they just started calling me Chong all the time.
Well, I thought some interesting things about their language was you said the word for anxiety is the same word for kill, and that the word later didn't come until, I guess, the missionaries came.
Yeah, well, actually, what didn't come until the missionaries came was the word lazy. Later was a concept that the Huarani No, you'd ask them, like, well, I brought a bunch of food with me into the territory once because I thought we'd be doing a long trek and I wanted to make sure there was enough. And the Warani, of course, insisted that I break it all out, and they ate the whole thing. 3 weeks' supplies we ate in 3 days. It was just gone. And I said, geez, shouldn't we save some for later? And they just looked at me and said, well, what's later? I mean, you know, there's no refrigeration, for example. So the idea of keeping food or keeping anything makes no sense to them. There's no sense of hoarding within the culture. There's no place to hide anything. And the Warani ideal is self-sufficiency. The idea is to be so in tune with the abundance of the forest that you can go out there and find whatever you need and support yourself that way. So there is no need to save things for later.
Did you learn when you were with them to live in the present tense? Because, boy, I think that's so hard to do if you live in our culture.
Yeah, no. I can't say that. I was always worried about what was going to happen next, for example. But it is something that I brought away from the Warani, my experience there, which is that the Warani do live so in the moment. I realize that's a cliche these days, but it's absolutely true, and they have to. There is so much going on around them in the forest all the time that they can't afford not to pay attention. And so their ability to concentrate and to see clearly is extraordinary and very inspiring. And I would see it translated when they came into, as they called it, my camp. After a while, the younger men were coming into the city and they would want to have a cannibal contact there. And I was at one point the only person they knew in Quito. You know, they would ride the buses up out of the territory using their spears for tickets. They knew if they made some spears that whenever anybody asked them for a ticket for the bus, they could just hand over a spear and that would work. And they would come to my camp and then they would hike through the city and they'd hike in single file like we were in a hunting out on a hunting party. And we would go hunting at the local supermarket, the Supermaxi, as it was called, and we would stalk, you know, frozen chickens and bring them back, carrying them on our heads back to my place. But always the Warani were watching, you know, watching, studying everything. And then they would come back and they could mimic all the people they had met. They could talk. For example, they did a great job of mimicking petroleum engineers, who have a certain way of talking, or of people like me, you know, writers coming down asking questions. They were just excellent students.
Will you describe a trip that deep into the forest where you literally felt like you were starving to death? You were lost. You had hypothermia. Did you think I'm not going to make it? I'm just not going to make it out of here.
Yes, I spent one whole night in particular, knowing I was starving to death. We were on a trek, so we weren't hunting. And in any case, the Warani can go for 8 to 10 days without eating anything and then sit down and at a single sitting eat 8 to 10 pounds of meat, a single adult Warani male. So they can go. I couldn't. You know, I wasn't adapted for that. And we hadn't eaten for at least 4 days and were hiking a lot, you know, 20, 25 miles a day sometimes.
And this is pretty rigorous hiking, I can imagine.
In rainforest, yeah, in hilly rainforest, slippery, slimy, all kinds of things biting you all the time, and you're hacking your way through the bush as you go, and you hike from dawn till dark. And we were lost, and the Warani were lost. We were outside the territory they knew, and we had to cut down trees. We had come to a river, the trail had ended, we were at a river, and we had to float that river, and we didn't know if we were going further into Warani territory, in which case we might find help, or if we were going south and east toward Peru, in which case we could go for weeks without coming across any other people.
Is it pretty unusual for the Warani to get lost?
They get lost, but they don't see it as lost, and they expect that something will happen. The Warani are very, they're very realistic. As Nkeri said to me at that point, I asked him, I said, Nkeri, where are we? And he said, we're in the forest. I said, yes, but where in the forest? And he said, well, I can't find the trail. And I said, what does that mean? And he says, well, it means we're lost. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, it means we might die. And it was a simple statement of fact, no hysteria attached to it, on his part anyway. And then we built our rafts, and 2 days later, some Warani found us in a canoe. They said they had been out on a hunting party and had this canoe piled high with monkey and wild boar, well, peccary actually, banana and manioc. And I asked them, I said, how did you find us? And they said, you can't hide anything from the Warani. And this is the sense they have, that even if they're lost, that they will figure something out. And they thought it was hilarious that we'd almost died. And of course, every Warani I was hiking with had to tell the story about, you know, the cannibal who fell off the bridges, made little fluttering signs with their hands, and they all found that hysterical.
Well, I like the stories you tell about how they tell time, because I think it shows both their humor, but also their ability to take in the outside culture and adapt it for their own.
Yeah, they... Well, in Kerry, for example, when he was one of the Warani men I got to know very well, Moy and Nanto being the others, and they're really who I write about in the book. But in Kerry was the first Warani I traveled with, and in Koke, he'd had me buy him an outfit for the forest, which was a camouflage hat, a faux Yves Saint Laurent belt, a pair of men's BVDs, and some cotton socks and some rubber boots. And that was it. That made him the coolest dude in the forest. And so I was, you know, setting off on this massive trek following a man in his underpants. But Inkeri already had a watch, and it didn't work, of course. I'm sure somebody had thrown it away or just given it to him because it was broken. But he would announce, you know, he would read it, and Moy would do it too. I'd ask him, what time is it? And they would say, it's 12 o'clock in Ecuador. It's 1 o'clock in the United States of North America. It's 2 o'clock in France. It's 3 o'clock in Japan. And it was this joke about, you know, keeping time by the hours. And even out trekking in the forest, Inkeri very seriously would announce, you know, today we will hike until 5 minutes after five. And of course, his watch didn't work. And I would ask him, Inkeri, when will it be 5 minutes after five? And he would say, in 1 hour and a half. And then we would hike for 8, 9, 10 hours. And he would announce out of nowhere, 5 minutes after five, you know, very seriously. And then we would make camp. But now in terms of, say, days, that was a different story. Mm. If I would see Moy or see Inkeri in the territory, I'd be leaving, you know, Inkeri would say, you know, Chong, I will come to your camp in 22 days. I would say, okay, great. Will you be alone? And always, yes, I'll be alone. Then 22 days later, I would return. I'd be in my apartment after, say, doing errands in Quito, and I'd return home, and there would be, you know, 6 or 12 or 18 Waorani standing out in front of the apartment, wearing their spears and their headdresses, scaring the bejesus out of the local folks just by their appearance, but right on time, 22 days. And they'd be there waiting for me, and then I would take them up into my camp where they would then start ransacking my apartment because, you know, I was clan by that point, so anything I had was theirs. You know, for Waorani, the highest manifestation of that ideal state of self-sufficiency was to give away whatever you had because you had no fear of need. So they would come out wearing all my clothes, all my great cannibal nylon jackets and things like that, always holding things up and saying, is this waterproof? Is this waterproof? Is this waterproof? And then wearing my ties wrapped around their heads like crowns.
Joe Kane's book, Savages, will be out in paperback later this summer. Coming up, a review of the new action thriller, The Rock. This is Fresh Air. Movies are usually thought of as the creations of actors and directors, but these days, many of Hollywood's most influential figures are producers. One such figure was the late Don Simpson, the man who gave us Beverly Hills Cop. Fresh Air film critic John Powers reviews Simpson's Last Testament.
In Hollywood, being a character is often mistaken for having it. When producer Don Simpson died last January, he was eulogized fondly by industry insiders. He was praised for being a self-made bad boy, driven, larger than life, a barrel of laughs at a party. No doubt, so was Caligula. The truth about Simpson was that he embodied much of what's rotten in today's Hollywood. I'm not referring here to his personal failings, his drug problems, his thuggish business style. No, the real horror of Don Simpson was that he, more than any other producer, was responsible for turning American movies into the noisy, glittering junk they've largely become. His blockbusters like Flashdance and Top Gun became the template for the new Hollywood movie. Gone was all interest in character or psychological depth. Gone any interest in ideas. For Simpson, movies were about pure sensation. All of which brings us to Simpson's last movie, The Rock, an action movie so seat-shaking loud, you can hear it with your buttocks. Ed Harris plays General Francis X. Hummel, a war hero who has legitimate beef with the U.S. government. Hummel and his crack military unit take over Alcatraz, known as The Rock, and threatened to kill everyone in San Francisco with deadly chemicals unless they're given $100 million. To stop them, the government launches a secret invasion of Alcatraz. The guide is John Patrick Mason, a longtime political prisoner who's the only man ever to escape from The Rock. Played by Sean Connery, Mason will lead the team through the island's underground tunnels until they find the bombs. Then they'll be defused by Stanley Goodspeed, a friendly but nervous FBI chemicals whiz who's not used to being around live ammo. Goodspeed is played by Nicolas Cage, and he spends much of the movie trying to get Connery's character to take him seriously.
You're right. I don't use guns, and I don't kick down doors. This is what I do.
I haven't got my glasses.
What it says is chemical weapons specialist. That's right. I got a lunatic up there, man. With 15 missiles armed with some really fucky stuff.
Not my Womack. You could have told my daughter.
It was classified. Look, I'm in the same situation. I got my girlfriend in the city with a baby on the way. Look, I can defuse the rockets. I really can. But I'm going to need your help. I'm going to need it right now.
In a sense, there are really two movies here. The first was made by Michael Bay, a one-time director of prize-winning commercials who has no apparent interest in anything human. Bay likes flashy images, you know, golden lights streaming through windows, enormous close-ups of spinning coins. And he loves to blow things up. His movie could be called Generic Action Picture, for that's precisely what it is. Its car chases, fireballs, and bad guys impaled on spikes could just as easily be in Die Hard, Speed, or Mission Impossible. If you love watching cable cars crunch yellow Ferraris very loudly, Michael Bay is the filmmaker for you. Luckily, there's a second, more enjoyable film that's been made by three of our finest and most virile screen actors, Harris, Connery, and Cage. This is a story about three decent men, a renegade general, an honest G-man, and a falsely imprisoned British spy, who've all been shafted by the U.S. government and now find themselves at violent cross-purposes. In playing these characters, each of the stars draws heavily on his familiar screen persona. Harking back to his work in The Right Stuff in Apollo 13, Harris gives General Hummel the clenched-jawed sincerity missing from today's hammy screen villains. Connery, playing what's essentially a white-haired version of James Bond, comes on like a sly old pro. He cruises through this movie as elegantly as 007's vintage Bentley. And Cage? Well, he's magnificently Nick Cage-ish. His Stanley Goodspeed is equal parts nerd and hipster, and he gets off some hilarious riffs. His comic byplay with Connery has the kind of charm you remember from older, better movies. To judge from the cheers of the preview audience, The Rock seems destined to be this week's monster hit. And why not? It's faster and more exciting than Mission Impossible. I only hope that somebody in Hollywood will realize that what makes the movie go is not all the Don Simpson stuff, all those MTV visuals and bombastic explosions. They're what slows the movie down. It's the small human moments between Harris, Connery, and Cage that make The Rock really rock.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue.
Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tui, with Alan Tu, Barbara Bogave, and Louisa Shafia. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Phoebe Van Scoy. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from William Morrow, publisher of Kenneth C. Davis's new book, Don't Know Much About the Civil War, Everything You Need to Know About America's Greatest Conflict But Never Learned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.